Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do mushrooms make the world a better place? Those of us who like to eat them delight in the way they can transform dinner, but scientists and entrepreneurs are far more excited by the potential of fungi to cure disease, keep forests vibrant, and purify areas contaminated by spilled oil, wastewater, and even nuclear accidents. Journalist Kenneth Miller writes about ongoing research in his article for the July-August issue of Discover magazine. The piece is called Mushroom Manifesto. Ken, welcome to Think.
Thanks.
So your central character in this piece is as fascinating as any of the species he's hunted and experimented with. Can you tell us about Paul Stamets and how he came to build his life around mycology?
Paul was a kid from a somewhat troubled family. His parents had broken up. His father had been a successful engineer, but after they divorced, he wound up living with his mother in poverty. He had a terrible stutter. And he wound up in college in the 70s, and he got very involved in the counterculture. And the first time he tried psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin, he went out into the woods, and he climbed a tree, and he was severely intoxicated, and a thunderstorm set in, and he was afraid he was going to die, and he started saying to himself, if I survive this, how can I change my life? And he started repeating over and over to himself, Paul, stop stuttering. Paul, stop stuttering. The storm ended. He climbed down. The next morning, he was walking down the street. He hadn't seen anybody else, and he ran into a young woman in his neighborhood who was quite beautiful and always made his stutter worse. And she said, how are you this morning, Paul? And he said, fine, thanks. How are you? Completely clearly. And he realized that he was on the way to actually curing his stutter. And he credited the psilocybin mushrooms for that change and started getting deciding to investigate those mushrooms. And he became an expert first at psilocybin, and then that led him to other mushrooms. And he decided that he would become a mycologist.
And at the time, it wasn't like there was a program in every major university, or even now that there's a program in every major university.
That's right. Mycology is a very, very small specialty. There are very few people in the field. And at that point, he went to Evergreen State University, which encouraged independent study. And he sought out an environmental science teacher who taught a course in mushrooms, though he was not really a mycologist, and said, I want you to teach me. Together, they set up a program for Paul. And part of what he learned to do was operate an electron scanning microscope. And in the process, he started seeing the structure of mushrooms and what is called mycelium, which is the sort of root-like network that mushrooms spring from, in ways that very few scientists had actually seen before him.
And you know, here in Texas, of course, it's sort of rare to see mushrooms pop up. We're having rain this week, so maybe we'll see some in a couple of days. But they are sort of present in the soil and underground all the time, and those mycelium are functioning in ways that we may not be aware of.
Right. And I should explain what mycelium is, really. Mushrooms are a form of fungus, and fungus is a variety of organism that is more closely related to animals than it is to plants, even though we think of it as something that grows in forests, grows in lawns. It's not a plant. Fungi and animals split off from the plant kingdom long, long ago, before they split off from each other. So they have some things in common with animals. They inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. They don't do photosynthesis. They live off of other organic matter, as we do. And their bodies are made up of this stuff called mycelium, which is a network of thread-like membranes that can suffuse. They can grow, in a piece of rotting fruit or throughout an entire forest.
And talk a little bit about the ways that the structures of the cells in mushrooms differ from those in plants.
Okay, so the structure of the cells in mushrooms are held together with something called, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, chitin. It's spelled C-H-I-T-I-N, instead of cellulose, which you would find in plants. And the thing about mushrooms is that they exude all sorts of enzymes and acids and things like that that allow them to live in a variety of environments. And they're susceptible to some of the same diseases we are. They can actually be attacked by viruses and bacteria. So they exude antibacterial and antiviral chemicals. And they also exude acids that can help them break down rocks so that they can turn the rock into minerals so that they can live on. And they exude enzymes, different species, different strains, exude enzymes that allow them to break down wood. And wood has these very intense hydrogen-carbon bonds, which are not that different from the hydrogen-carbon bonds in hydrocarbons or petroleum. And that leads to all sorts of interesting uses as well.
You share some remarkable examples here of the ways that mycelia that produce mushrooms resemble human brains in terms of the ways they communicate and chemical signals. Tell us about that.
So one of the things when Paul Stamets was looking through his electron microscope as a college student, he noticed that the structure of mycelia, which is the plural for mycelium, looked a lot like the structures the structure of a human brain, the way brain cells are wired together. It's a sort of a branching network of threads, and if you look at a picture of the two, you really would have a hard time telling them apart. And one of Stamets's wonderful insights is that both mycelium and human brains do some similar things and are probably structured similarly for that reason. Mycelium that is branching through a forest is communicating at a distance. Some of these mycelium live in the roots of trees, and they get sugar from the roots, and in turn they contribute minerals and things to the roots. And if they find that a tree is not getting enough nutrition, they can signal to mycelium hundreds of yards away and say, hey, send us over some, you know, some of this or some of that. And so they're communicating across a distance and signaling to each other using chemical messengers, much the way the brain does.
So in other words, they're basically cultivating what someday will be a terrific food source for them.
Well, absolutely, yeah. So it's they live in a symbiotic relationship with all sorts of plants. In the forest, they help nourish trees. In farm fields, they help nourish the roots of crops, and they can be used, you know, it's to their advantage, and it could also be used to our advantage.
So at least as far back as Hippocrates, our ancestors recognized that certain mushrooms, certain sort of fungal entities seem to be useful in keeping wounds free of infection?
That's right. There's, I mean, mushrooms have been used in medicine for thousands and thousands of years. The famous Iceman, Uzi, who was found in a glacier in the Italian Alps a few years ago, was carrying a pouch with a bag full of a mushroom called amadou. Amadou mushrooms were used to start fires. They're very good kindling. They were also used as bandages because they absorb, they're very absorptive, and they also kill bacteria. So these things have many, many different uses.
And they're still used medicinally in Asia. Is there some reason why in the West we have been less enthusiastic about exploring these substances?
You know, it's an interesting question. Paul Stamets' idea is that the West is sort of afraid of mushrooms. He calls it biological racism or mycophobia. You know, it is a long-time tradition in Asia and in parts of South America. But for reasons I don't think anybody really knows, it sort of fell out of favor in the West. Now, we use fungi for microfungi for a lot of things. So microfungi are things like yeasts and molds. Mm-hmm. Macrofungi fungi are the larger visible fungi that create mushrooms. And so we do use yeasts for things like bread and beer, and molds for things like cheese, and also molds for some medications like penicillin. There are antibiotics that are made with molds. But somehow mushrooms have been overlooked.
What is it like to go on a mushroom hunt with a guy like Paul Stamets?
I don't know if there is a guy like Paul Stamets.
With Paul Stamets, let's put it that way.
But with Paul Stamets himself, he is so passionate about this field. This is the love of his life is mushrooms. And if you go into the woods, I went out with him on an island off of Vancouver in British Columbia on a mushroom, 5-day mushroom workshop. And every morning we would get up early in the morning, and of course it's very rainy there. We go into the woods in this thick fir and alder forest, and it's raining, and Paul is just raring to go, and he charges ahead, and he's jumping over stumps, and he's charging up hills, and he's wading through puddles, and there are about a dozen of us struggling to keep up with him, and he's going really fast, and then he'll stop, and he'll say, aha, here's a Mycena alkalina, and he'll say, smell this, and it smells like chlorine. And he says, okay, you know what this means? It means that it might be useful for cleaning up PCBs, which are polychlorinated biphenols, which are, you know, terrible pollutant. And he sees a potential for that. And then you go a little bit longer, and he'll stop at a fallen tree and say, aha, here's an agaricon. Agaricons can be used to fight weaponized smallpox and bird flu. And it goes on like that all day, and he never gets tired.
Are we too afraid of wild mushrooms that might kill us if we nibble the wrong kind? Or is that fear justified?
Oh, that fear is absolutely justified. And like many things in nature, mushrooms can be both helpful and quite harmful. In fact, any kind of fungi. If you're out there looking for a delicious chanterelle, you better be sure that that's what it really is, because you can actually get something that looks like it that can definitely kill you. And likewise with things like molds, molds can also be extremely harmful. There are all sorts of toxic molds. They can destroy foodstuffs. They can attack plants. But the other members of these of the fungal kingdom can be extremely helpful, and you just have to really become expert at knowing the difference.
Now, Stamets goes out and gives these workshops out in the wild, but of course his main business is cultivating these things. Are certain forms really hard to grow in a lab setting or a farm setting?
Yes, absolutely. And one of his, another of his many fungal passions is trying to figure out ways to grow those things agriculturally. So he's got a patch of morels behind his main grow room in a patch of woods, and he's figured out a way. He's maybe the first person to figure out a way to grow morels intentionally as opposed to just foraging for them in the wild. But mushrooms, there are hundreds of thousands of species, and many of them require a very, very specialized environment to grow in, and you just can't reproduce it on a farm.
My guest is journalist Kenneth Miller. His new article in the July-August issue of Discover magazine is called Mushroom Manifesto. We'll continue our discussion in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Kenneth Miller, author of the article Mushroom Manifesto in the July-August issue of Discover magazine. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So how did Paul Stamets start to build his business as a mushroom grower, and what did he intend his sort of career path to be in that regard?
Well, Paul, when he was in college, was really a sort of a prodigy, and he actually published a book on psilocybin mushrooms and was becoming nationally known just as an undergraduate. But after he graduated from Evergreen State, he didn't have enough money to go to grad school. And so he said, well, how am I going to afford to pursue my scientific interests? I guess I'll start a business. So he started a business selling gourmet and medicinal mushrooms out of his garage in his house. And he had a lab there. And he started also teaching grow-it-yourself workshops, and all this was meant to finance his scientific work. But he wound up buying a 20-acre farm off of the Puget Sound up in Washington State, and going into the mushroom business really full bore. So he's got this by now a very thriving business that sells nutritional supplements both online and at grocery stores, health food stores, and all kinds of gardening kits and stuff like that. And he's also got these very fancy labs on the premises in which he does his sort of larger experiments.
But then the feds came calling. He had a problem.
He did have a problem. In the 1980s, right after he bought this farm, local authorities, I guess it wasn't the feds, it was actually the sheriff's department, came about a week after he moved in and said, well, you know, we've got these oyster beds on Puget Sound, particularly on Skookum Inlet, which is the area that he lived, and we've got a lot of pollution coming down from fecal coliform bacteria from people's sewage systems and from farm fields, and there is a law here that everybody who lives within a certain distance of Skookum Inlet has to install a septic system, a modern septic system, to prevent contamination of the oyster beds. Mm-hmm. Paul had a problem, which was that he couldn't afford to install a new septic system. But he knew from his work that mushroom mycelia can act as filters. They look like filters when you look at them through an electron microscope, and that they can trap and kill and consume bacteria. They actually eat bacteria, certain species anyway. And he knew that garden giant mushrooms were very good at doing this. And so he spread a truckload of wood chips across his property. And on top of that, he poured what's called spawn, which is a mixture of a growing medium like sawdust or rice with mushroom spores that start to grow. And he mixed it in with the wood chips and planted a huge bed of mushrooms on his property. After about a year, when the authorities came back to test the bacterial runoff from his property, they found that it had decreased 100-fold, and it wasn't a problem anymore.
And that was essentially a full-scale working model of something he'd been experimenting on as a graduate student.
As a student, he had seen the potential of mushrooms to do this sort of thing, but he hadn't really been able to do a field experiment. So this was his first big field experiment, and it worked really well. And he started installing similar devices, if you can call them, for other farmers in the area. Eventually started doing it for the county where he lived. And it also attracted the interests of all kinds of other scientists. So after he had had this successful run reducing the bacterial runoff from his property, a group of scientists from an environmental remediation company came to him and said, well, you know what? We've been working on trying to clean up oil spills using fungi. Hmm. That was a big idea in the 80s. But all the remediators, most of them anyway, were trying to use various kinds of molds to do it. And the molds worked well in the laboratory, but not very well in the field. And they said, Paul, do you have any idea of what we could use that would work better for cleaning up oil spills in soil? And Paul said, well, you know, oyster mushrooms can grow just about anywhere. They're very aggressive at breaking down wood. Maybe they'd be really good at that, too. So he sent them a bunch of oyster mushrooms, and they set up an experiment in the lab of this bioremediation company. And the oyster mushrooms, indeed, when you poured oil on top of oyster mushroom spawn, the oyster mushrooms started eating the oil, and they grew up right through the oil, and they absorbed it. So this gave Paul his next great big idea.
And not only do they eat up the oil, but then within a couple of weeks, other life forms, little plants and things, start to sprout up in the same area, whereas the control area, nothing happened.
Okay, so that's the next experiment. So first he did this small-scale thing in a lab, and then he was approached by scientists from a big national scientific technical organization called Battelle Laboratories. And they said, hey, we're looking for ways to do environmental cleanup, and we heard about this. Let's do a bigger experiment. So Stamets got together with these Battelle researchers, and the Washington State Department of Transportation had a very badly polluted trucking site where they had just tons of oil of soil that was contaminated with diesel fuel. And so Stamets and the Battelle researchers set up an experiment where they had three different ways of trying to break down this oil. One was bacteria. There's two different. One was using bacteria. The other was a control bed where they didn't do anything. And then the other was using oyster mushrooms. And when they planted oyster mushrooms on this pile of diesel-soaked dirt, yes, after a few weeks, not only was the oil content reduced tremendously, but mushrooms started popping up on the soil. Birds and insects came to eat the mushrooms. Hmm. Birds came to eat the insects, depositing plant seeds. And pretty soon the whole pile was covered with plants and was clean enough to be used for commercial purposes, for road land, for filling roadways and stuff like that, where it had been too contaminated before.
Is there any problem with getting enough mushrooms to grow over the field of a large spill? You know, I'm imagining, you know, there are concentrations that, like after the Exxon Valdez spill, and you know, along shorelines where it's miles and miles of land area.
Yeah, and that's a big challenge. One of the great things about mushrooms is they grow really fast, as anybody who lives in a damp environment with a lawn can testify. And so Stamets has come up, one of his many innovations is to come up with ways of growing mushrooms in huge quantities very quickly. And a thing he came up with in the last just couple of years is a way to grow them on straw soaked in salt water. So if you've got an offshore oil spill, you could pretty quickly you'd be growing fields of straw, and you would cut it down, soak it in salt water, and very quickly you would be able to grow thousands, if not millions of tons of mushrooms to be used for this kind of purpose.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. My question's about the concentrated dried mushrooms and capsules at health food stores, and there are all kinds of varieties, and I would just like to get your guests' comments on those and the possible benefits or not. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Do you know anything about those, Ken?
Yeah, so another one of Stamets's obsessions is using mushrooms for medicine. And as I mentioned, they have lots of different compounds, antibacterial and antiviral compounds, that they use to defend themselves in nature, because they can be infected like animals with germs. And they've learned to fight them off in different mushroom species, and then different strains within those species, different slight genetic variations within those species can be very effective at fighting off different diseases. So there are things like agaricon, which he has done experiments in cooperation with some government laboratories, and which turn out to be effective against things like bird flu and pox viruses of various kinds. Mushrooms also, besides having those antiviral and antibacterial properties, can also have apparently cancer-fighting properties and immune system-strengthening properties. And so one of the experiments that Stamets was involved in had to do with turkey tail mushrooms. And turkey tail mushrooms, there was a 7-year trial of these things, a university-run experiment, and they found that turkey tail mushrooms strengthened the immune systems of women who had had radiation therapy for breast cancer, which helped them fight off secondary infections and secondary cancers and things like that, and improved their health outcomes. Stamets had personal implications for him, because his mother was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer in her 80s while this experiment was going on. He put her on turkey tail mushrooms, and she went into full remission. Now, was that because of the mushrooms? You never know exactly, but there's a lot of work going on to investigate turkey tail and all kinds of other mushrooms for this kind of use. Now, Stamets sells a lot of different concentrates and compounds, and by law, he can't really say that they cure any particular thing or prevent any particular thing, but he sells them as general immune system boosters. And there has been a lot of work in different labs, some of it connected with Stamets, that shows that some of these mushrooms may indeed have just that kind of effect. But it's tough to say, you know, this cures that, this will prevent that. And that's the sort of thing you have to make your own decision about whether you want to try it. There has not been the kinds of mushrooms that he's using in these capsules, there's been no harm shown to them. So if you want to make yourself an experiment, well, that's what you're doing, basically.
What kind of reputation does this guy have in the academic community, given that, although his work seems to be very sincere, he is running a for-profit company that he owns and manages, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, there are people who are very suspicious of that. Having hung out with him for a week, my sense is that he's a very sincere guy and is very just driven by this very pure passion. But yeah, he's also in business. But interestingly, he is working with all kinds of actual, you know, university qualified researchers and publishing stuff with them in peer reviewed journals. So he really does have some legitimacy. One of the people I talked to about him, a guy named Eric Rasmussen, who's a veteran disaster relief coordinator who is working with him on some of his projects, compared Stamets to somebody like Thomas Edison or some of those guys during the Renaissance who were not just scientists, and they were certainly not academic scientists, and they were doing something else, and in some cases even entrepreneurs, but they were also really very legitimate scientists who made a lot of breakthroughs, and that's sort of where he falls in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Fastum from Dallas. Hi, Fastum.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I have a question for him. What is the best way to find out which one is a toxic or which one is healthy mushrooms? And is any animal depend on those mushrooms that eating for his life?
Okay. Thanks for your call. The line was a little tough to hear. Ken Festen was interested in how to figure out which ones are toxic and which ones aren't. Is there a book that people go to that is sort of the golden book of mushrooms?
There are a number of very good mushroom hunting books, and all of them will caution you, don't just rely on a book. It's really important if you're starting out to do your own foraging to go with someone who knows what they're doing and can point stuff out to you. But I think also the caller was asking about how to find out which of these mushrooms may actually have health properties, beneficial health properties. What I did when I was researching this article was I went on to Google Scholar and typed in the name of the species I was interested in, and you'll come up with scientific papers. And that's a sort of a primary way to do it. And you can look at those scientific papers yourself and see what the results have been. And he also asked about animals that eat mushrooms. And it is the case that many different animals eat many different kinds of mushrooms, from truffles to mushrooms that grow above the ground. And animals, when they eat mushrooms, it help to spread the mushroom spores around. And so there is this, you know, very close natural relationship between mushrooms and mammals, where they help us by nourishing us, and we help them by spreading their seeds.
Are animals instinctively better than we are without a book and a guide at figuring out which ones are good for them and which ones aren't?
Yes, they are. Yeah. And nobody knows, I don't think, what the mortality rate may be among animals who try the wrong kind of mushrooms. But animals in general seem to be quite good at, just through scent and perhaps through some sort of genetic programming, at knowing what they should be eating. Human beings, unfortunately, don't have that advantage at all. And things that look really delicious can, in fact, be quite deadly. So again, be careful, get a good book. Take a mushroom hunting workshop if you're interested in this stuff, so that you can get really good at it before you go off and try to do it on your own.
Journalist Kenneth Miller is with us. We're talking about his article, Mushroom Manifesto, which is featured in the current issue of Discover Magazine. We'll be taking more of your calls and emails after the break. You can get to us by phoning 1-800-933-5372 or sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Kenneth Miller, author of Mushroom Manifesto, an article featured in the July-August issue of Discover Magazine. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Ken, as a lot of people are aware, when there is nuclear radiation that's contaminated soil around any kind of accident site, sometimes this contamination can persist for decades, requiring the removal of soil and sort of burial underground to protect everyone around it. What sort of work has been done to use mushrooms to remediate some of those areas?
So it's been known for a while that mushrooms can absorb heavy metals of various kinds from the soil, and that includes radioactive heavy metals. And there even, it's come out since the Chernobyl meltdown in the 80s, that there are mushrooms that thrive on radiation. They can somehow convert the radiation from nuclear waste or the interior of a nuclear reactor into energy that they can grow on. And so when the Fukushima meltdown happened, about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. Stamets immediately thought, wow, I wonder if we could use mushrooms to clean this up. And in fact, the compounds that contaminated the soil around Fukushima are known to be absorbable by some mushrooms. And so the question is whether you can plant enough of them and whether these could actually be used to draw the radioactivity out of the soil, draw out the radioactive isotopes. And so Stamets published an online manifesto saying, we can do this. He got the interest of some very legitimate investors and academics and other people and has started a company with the intention of actually going to Fukushima and doing this. So at the moment, what they are doing is they're doing an experiment where they're taking cesium-137, which is the principal contaminant around Fukushima, and they're getting some of this from a decommissioned nuclear facility called Hanford. And then at Lawrence Livermore Labs, a bunch of scientists are experimenting with different strains of certain species of mushrooms where they're growing them on soil contaminated with cesium-137 and seeing whether they can get enough of this stuff out of the soil that it could be used practically. So the plan would be, if it works, to go to Fukushima, use a lot of the debris that's lying around there, wood debris, put it through a chipper to make it a suitable substrate for growing mushrooms on, spread mushroom spores over this so that you're growing these mushrooms, and then after they come to fruition, send people in hazmat suits to harvest the mushrooms, and then you would take the mushrooms and you would dispose of them as nuclear waste. And you would do this for as many years as it takes to fully contaminate the soil around Fukushima.
Well, what's amazing about that is I would imagine that the volume of waste from those mushrooms, especially because they're going to sort of lose their water as they decompose, is going to be vastly less than cubic tons of soil.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So it takes up a lot less space. You can get rid of it a lot more easily. And the other nice thing is that really the only alternative is to either wait hundreds of thousands of years until the radiation goes away by itself, or take this soil, dig it up, truck it all to some facility and keep all this soil as nuclear waste, and then you don't have the soil anymore. You've got to get soil from somewhere else and bring it in if you want to grow anything. And this is some of the best soil in Japan. So Stamets's idea is that sometime in the next few decades, you might actually be able to grow stuff on this great soil again if you can pull out the radioactive isotopes using mushrooms.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bethany in Richardson on the line now. Hi, Bethany.
Hi. You actually touched on one of my questions that I was going to ask, but you kind of inspired a new question. So with the experiment that you mentioned earlier with the oil, using the mushrooms to kind of soak it up, would they harvest those mushrooms as well? Or you mentioned that, like, you know, the life around those mushrooms were thriving, but how do you know, like, what the long-term effects of having those mushrooms, like, being used to absorb that oil would be?
That's a really great question, and it sort of depends on the kind of oil that you're soaking up. So some oil contains heavy metals, and that can be a problem if you're going to eat the mushrooms afterwards, if anything is going to eat the mushrooms afterwards, because those can be toxic. But there are also petroleum products that don't contain heavy metals. And if they're fairly pure, they can actually be broken down completely so that the mushrooms convert, this is a bit of weird science, they convert the hydrocarbons of the oil into carbohydrates that they can digest fully. And so the mushrooms, as far as can be determined, really are fine for at least for animals to eat. It may be that there would be some resistance to selling them in stores, but as far as in the natural life cycle, they would be fine. If those mushrooms have taken up heavy metals from petroleum products that have those, it may be more problematic, and I think more work needs to be done to find out how problematic or not it would be.
Can you tell us a little bit about mushrooms or fungi being used as natural pesticides?
Mm-hmm, sure. And by the way, some people say fungi. Paul Stamets says fungi. And since hanging out with him, I've started to say fungi. but one of Stamets's breakthroughs was to discover a better way to kill carpenter ants, which branches out into other insect pests as well. And what happened was when he bought that farmhouse in Washington State in the 80s, it was really falling down, and it was the floorboards were rotting, and it was infested with carpenter ants. And eventually it just became too much of a nuisance. And he said, how am I going to get rid of these carpenter ants? Well, of course, being a mycologist, he thought, I'm going to look into a mycological, that is a mushroom-related or a fungal pesticide. And he looked into it, and he found there were some fungal pesticides, but they didn't work well on social insects like carpenter ants, because the ants could smell the spores, and if you sprayed an ant with this stuff, the other ants would not let it into the nest. Mm-hmm. And so that was a real problem. So what he did was he found a way to grow a particular kind of a mold on rice and prevent it from growing spores immediately. In nature, it would just immediately sporulate, as they say. But he found a way to genetically engineer it just through breeding and repeated generation of these things in petri dishes, so that the spores didn't come out until later. And then he put it on rice, set it out as bait in his own kitchen, and the carpenter ants came and took this stuff. It smelled good to them. They thought, here's food. And they brought it back to the nest, and then the spores formed and infected the carpenter ants. And what happens when they eat this stuff is the spores germinate, and they send mycelia, these threads of fluffy stuff, throughout the bodies of the ants, and it kills the ants. And not only that, once it's done that, other ants stay away from the house because they can smell the spores. So he was able to rid his house permanently of carpenter ants in a few weeks by using this method that's completely non-toxic to other animals and very cheap and very efficient. And ever since then, he's been trying to find a way to make that industrially, commercially viable. And he seems to be, he's got a bunch of patents out on it, and that should be happening sometime within the next few years.
It sounds like a great idea if you can convince people to wait that few weeks. You know, so many times we want, like, we see an insect and we want an instant eradication, but at peril to the environment sometimes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it's not as quick as some methods, but it seems to be more permanent, and it has no bad side effects for other creatures. And he's found by selectively breeding different strains of these molds, he's found a way to use it now with termites, even with mosquitoes, with a whole bunch of different insects. And this can be useful not only for getting those things out of your house, but possibly for mosquito control in places where malaria is a problem, and things like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Rob in Fort Worth. Hello, Rob.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Cool show. I have three questions. Is there a website that we can access with Mr. Stamets? How do you spell his name? And are there any plans on the purification of the septic systems?
Yes, on all those things. So you spell his name, it's Paul, P-A-U-L. Last name is Stamets. S is in Sam, T is in tornado. A, M is in Mary, E, T is in Tom, S as in Sam. S-T-A-M-E-T-S, Stamets. And he's got a website, which, gosh, let me just get this up here.
I think the spelling of his name, Rob can probably Google that.
You'll find it. Just Google it. Google Paul Stamets and you'll find his website. And then the question about plans for using mushrooms for filtration, you can go on his website, and I think there are ways to get a hold of that. You may have to go to him directly, but there are ways to do that. But really, the website would be the portal for that. He has published a couple of articles about that as well, which you might find in your Googling, too.
It does seem that there is a growing interest, certainly by investors, but also by government entities and scientific grant makers.
Yes. And so Stamets has really gotten the attention of everybody from Silicon Valley investors who are trooping to see him about his various inventions, people and people like the guys who run Google and Bill Gates have all had brainstorming sessions with him. And then he's also worked with the government BioShield program, which was looking for ways to counter biological weapons. The EPA has now given him a grant for larger field experiments with that his methods for filtering wastewater runoff. He's getting attention from high places in the last few years.
I would imagine, I don't know how interested you were in mycology before you worked on this piece, but even the photographs that accompany it are fascinating, and they're a reminder of how many different forms mushrooms can take.
And so mushrooms come in a whole, the classic mushroom-shaped mushroom, but they can also grow in shapes that look like flying saucers, that look like beehives, that look like blobs. There are woody mushrooms and fleshy mushrooms and gigantic mushrooms and very tiny mushrooms. And they're wonderful to look at. Just an incredibly varied bunch of species.
And there's this thing called the lion's mane mushroom that is interesting, and people are looking into it to possibly treat some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's?
So there has been experimentation with this particular species of mushroom, the lion's mane, which is called that because it looks like a hairy, a massive hair, sort of like a lion's mane. Some Japanese researchers have done some serious work where it looks like both in the test tube and in lab animals that lion's mane mushrooms might be able to regenerate nerve cells and to repair the kind of damage that you see in Alzheimer's disease. And there's even been a small trial with Alzheimer's patients who took this stuff and showed significant improvement. Again, all this stuff is sort of in its infancy, this sort of research. And nobody can honestly say to you, go out and take lion's mane and it'll cure your grandmother's Alzheimer's.
Right.
But there's a lot of promise and a lot of work being done in this field. And Stamets is, of course, one of the great people who's pushing it to happen.
So no reason to interfere when mushrooms do spring up on the lawn after a rainstorm.
Well, you might want to figure out what kind they are and whether you can use them for some other purpose. But no, do not see them as your enemy. They can be your friend.
The article Mushroom Manifesto is in the current issue of Discover magazine. That's the July-August issue. And it was written by journalist Kenneth Miller, who's been our guest this hour. Ken, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help from Joe Bellotti on the phones, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free podcast at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.